Good morning, Your Honors. Joanna Schiavone on behalf of the appellant, Albert Lucero. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, but I will watch the clock.
Okay.
May it please the court. So the briefing obviously raised two issues in this case, the Bruton error and the sufficiency of the evidence issue regarding the weapon charge. But I'm going to focus my argument today, subject to the court's questions, I'm going to focus on the Bruton error and specifically the harmless error or the prejudice aspect of that argument. So turning to the prejudice piece, the error was not...
Well, let's start with a question on the Bruton issue of why this is covered by Crawford. I don't see why it is.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why is this Bruton error, given Crawford's focus on testimonial?
Well, I think the really important point here, Your Honor, is that it wasn't litigated in the trial court, as you know, because essentially the government, the prosecutor,
conceded. But it was litigated in the trial court. Which trial court?
In state? In the state trial court.
It wasn't. Does that matter?
The Crawford piece of the issue, because
I know it wasn't, but I'm asking if that matters.
It does matter, and I think for two important reasons. One is that the prosecutor in the case specifically argued that, or essentially conceded, arguing that it was a Bruton error to admit the WILA, this testimonial statement by the co-defendant, without redaction, and made that argument very forcefully to the court that if it was redacted in the way that was offered at trial.
Well, that's all true, but now we're in federal habeas, and we have to find a federal constitutional error. And do you have any case law for the proposition that we apply some form of waiver to the government? I mean, it's really an argument for exhaustion by the government.
Both judicial
estoppel. I mean, does it seem fair? Yes. But is there any case law? No, as far as I know.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that both that the doctrine of judicial estoppel and the doctrine of waiver could both and should both apply here, given the forceful nature of the argument below and that it wasn't litigated.
Don't we have to apply Crawford, though? This court has to apply Crawford, does it not?
The court certainly has to apply Crawford, Your Honor, but the court can reach the conclusion that it was essentially a conceded point below. And I think that both
doctrines... But not below. That's the problem. It wasn't below. It was in the state court. State court isn't below. I mean,
yeah. So in the original proceedings, I should say, and so essentially that claim was never litigated, and I don't think the government claims that it was ever litigated within the California courts. And so it does.
Okay,
I think
is there
under
any
the
requirement that it be litigated in the California courts in order, or can we grant habeas on the ground that it wasn't litigated in the California courts? Do you have any support for that proposition?
The support, Your Honor, is turning to the doctrines, I think, of judicial estoppel and of waiver, and
but
that
judicial estoppel requires that they have gotten some advantage from this. What advantage should they get?
They
got a disadvantage. They didn't get an advantage.
The advantage obtained was that throughout the trial, in the argument to the original trial court, and throughout the trial, the prosecutor argued and frankly claimed to the jury that it was a testimonial statement by the co-defendant and argued that to the trial court in order to obtain admission of the WILA itself, and argued that point to the jury very forcefully in supporting the persuasive value of the evidence, which I think there's no dispute
it wasn't testimonial in the sense of Crawford, though, was it? It was in the sense of Crawford that it was prepared in anticipation of testimony or for some kind of law enforcement or court use?
Well, Your Honor, I think under this court's precedent, in terms of the testimonial question, the case that I cited, Esparza, actually is very useful on this point, to your point about testimonial. That was the case in which the evidence at issue was a statement given to the DMV. And the investigation into that offense, it was related to the sale of a car and an underlying offense there. The statement that was submitted to the DMV, a government agency, was submitted while an investigation was going on.
But this wasn't submitted to a government agency, and it wasn't...
The DMV.
Pursued... What?
To the DMV.
No, but in this case, it wasn't submitted to a government agency, and moreover, it wasn't part of an investigation by any government agency.
Well, I think the important fact from Esparza, Your Honor, in addition to it having been submitted to the government agency, was it wasn't solicited by the government. It was simply prepared by the seller of the car in the same way, I think analogous to this case, that the WILA was written by someone after the investigation had already begun. So the investigation...
Isn't it a key distinction that in Esparza you're talking about preparing something for a government agency? Everyone knew that was the purpose of that. Here this was prepared as an inter-agency memo for a gang. There was never any anticipation that it was going to be used for the government or for an investigation. So I'd like you to address how would it meet Crawford, even if you don't think that we have to apply Crawford. How would the huila that was prepared by a gang member meant to be sent to another gang member, how is that prepared in anticipation of testimony?
So, Your Honor, turning again back to the point that the investigation had been concluded, had it been initiated, immediately after the assault in this case, it was investigated, evidence was collected from the gang members, clothing was taken, the quarters were evaluated, investigated, search for weapon was conducted. And so the analogy I guess I would make under it being testimonial is that even though it wasn't solicited by the government, I will concede that point, it certainly was not. It was prepared by a purported gang member. Neither was the statement in Esparza solicited by the government. And so the point I think that the most analogous fact I can pull from Esparza is that the investigation was ongoing. The gang members or purported gang members all knew the investigation was ongoing. It was prepared and then identified and found during the search that was conducted the following day by Deputy Taso. So that's the where I would say that it's testimonial, in addition to the fact that the government, in the original state court proceedings, argued very persuasively and consistently that it would have been a Bruton error to admit it because it was a testimonial statement by a co-defendant. So that's the most analogous point I can offer, Your Honor, on Esparza under the Crawford doctrine. The other thing I would point out is that Crawford is a 2004 decision, and even the subsequent cases in the Supreme Court, the Michigan case v. Bryant, that was all adjudicated in 2006. The trial in this case didn't happen until 2007. The appellate proceedings took place in 2009. That doctrine was very well established, and again, I would turn back to the point that none of the arguments were raised in the original trial court and having the chance to litigate that below. So hopefully I've answered to the best of my ability your question, Your Honor.
Well, do you agree that if under Crawford that it was not an error to utilize this statement, that there would have been no error?
The question is if you conclude that it was not testimonial
as defined under Crawford,
then I think that is certainly a significant barrier to the Bruton claim, because we know under this court's jurisprudence and under the Supreme Court jurisprudence that those doctrines are intertwined, that Bruton must comply with the Crawford doctrine, testimonial versus non-testimonial. So, yes, I would concede that point if you find that as a legal matter, overcoming both judicial estoppel and waiver in this case, which I think there are very strong factual bases to exercise this court's discretion and apply those doctrines.
Could you address the Schenck question a bit?
The
other issue in the case?
Yes, the Jackson issue. So with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, the on count three, with respect to the possession of the weapon, our argument is that no rational jury could have found, absent the huila evidence, that there was possession of a shank. The under California law, which applies in terms of the constructive possession doctrine, there was no evidence of that constructive possession.
What is constructive possession? You write in your brief as if it is essentially accomplice liability or something like that. Is that constructive possession? In other words, the brief reads as if there was some agreement that this shank would be used among the three or four of them, then that was constructive possession. Is it?
Constructive possession under California law requires knowing control. It's a control question. And so it's
control over the particular use of the shank. Is it enough that a bunch of people get together and agree that somebody is going to use a shank? That's the way your brief reads, but I'm not at all sure that's what constructive possession is.
Constructive, it's knowing exercise of control or the right to control whatever the object is. So if it's drugs or a weapon, it's knowing control or the right to control it.
So you have agreement. So there's a difference between a constructive possession that says I can take this shank and use it, it's in my constructive possession, even though I don't have it right now, or I know it's somebody else's, and I know that person's going to use it, but I'm going along with it. So which one is it? Or is doing it on my behalf? Is that constructive possession? It makes a difference, and there was no briefing on this question.
So the way that this is treated, as I read the California cases and having litigated and issues similar to this, it really focuses on control, and it's not so much the theoretical question about a group agreeing. It's not the same thing as an agreement, a conspiracy, or accomplice liability, or something like that with some overt act.
All right, well, your brief reads as if it is. So if it isn't, why don't you tell us how this case reads if it's something more different than that?
So, for example, and the most analogous case I can think of is in a drug situation, if it's underneath the seat in the car.
People versus Howard.
I'm sorry?
You're talking about People versus Howard.
Yeah, so if it's underneath the seat of a car, but it's out of reach, similar with a gun, with drugs, but if they exercise control over that automobile, then courts have found that they're exercising control over whatever that object is. But here, again, the evidence is so thin because it really the only evidence of this is this inferential evidence about the nature of the injuries and then the one statement in the huila itself about it being flushed, the shank essentially being flushed. And so there's no evidence to make that logical leap of a dominion or control over something that there's such flimsy evidence even existed. I hope that answers your question.
What about the expert testimony that it was a policy of the gang to keep weapons at the ready and that they would have known that?
Again, Your Honor, I would turn back to the fact that all of that testimony given by Deputy Teso was tied specifically to each statement in the huila, and that the testimony he offered that removals often are fatal if they involve quote-unquote degenerate acts. Again, it was all tied to the huila itself. And so the argument is, our position is that's not enough to prove the element of dominion or control over the object itself that is highly disputed ever existed. So I'll
thank you.
I know I've gone over my time.
Thank
so
you very
if,
much.
If the court will allow me 1 minute, I'd appreciate it.
I will allow you 1 minute.
Thank you.
With regard to the first issue, simply put, habeas is meant to guard against extreme malfunctions in the criminal.
Are you going to tell us who you are first?
I'm sorry. Luis Martinez, appearing for the people. With regard to the first issue, habeas is meant to guard against extreme malfunctions in the criminal.
Do you have any explanation for why this case unfolded as it did, i.e., why it was that everybody was convinced in the state court that this was a confrontation, a Bruton problem, apparently, and it would be interesting to know why.
I could only offer speculation.
I mean, that's a lot of people. It's the prosecutor and the defense and the judge and everybody else.
I could only offer speculation, Your Honor. The first California authority I'm aware of that specifically ties Bruton to Crawford, I believe, occurred.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The
first California authority that I'm specifically aware of, California as opposed to federal courts, that specifically tied Crawford to Bruton would have been in 2011.
Well, that cuts the opposite direction.
I'm sorry?
That cuts in the opposite direction. In other words, why, when this case was tried, was everyone treating this as a Crawford problem?
Well,
or as a Bruton problem?
Right, and they would have not.
I mean, your notion is that people thought Bruton was something other than that was governed by some set of rules other than the Crawford rules.
I could only.
Does California possibly have a different confrontation clause understanding than under its own constitution?
We all follow the Constitution, Your Honor.
Well, excuse me. There is a state constitution, and there are many instances in which the state constitution is different, and I'm asking you whether it could be true in this instance.
Oh,
more protectively.
I'm not aware of any difference between the state and federal confrontation clauses, Your Honor, with regard to this.
All right. Well, go ahead. I mean, this is a peculiar thing because this document kind of reads like it sort of is testimonial. It's just within the gang rather than to the government. I mean, it was a testimony given to the gang members, right, for their own internal governance purposes.
Well,
apparently.
You might look at it as a business record, Your Honor. I wouldn't look at it as testimonial under Bryant simply because it wasn't procured with the contemplation that it would, or for the primary purpose of being used as a substitute for in court
testimony.
Well,
it kind of was, but within the gang rather than in the larger society.
Right, within the gang, but that has nothing to do with whether it was contemplated to be presented in a court of law, which is what...
Well, how about the Esparza case? Was that contemplated to be used within court of law? Maybe it was because of the timing of it. But it other than that, it was just a routine administrative document.
Well,
right?
And if it had been in a routine administrative document, it may very well not have come under Crawford. However, the circumstances in Esparza are quite different because the person who prepared this form or the party who owned the car had already been given notice.
That's true, but the document was just an ordinary governmental administrative document.
Right.
That millions of people fill out every day for non-testimonial purposes.
But given the context of it.
All right, thanks.
With regard to the second issue, it's clear under California law that two people can possess an item at the same time, and of course
true. No, there are a lot of problems. A, this item is pretty ephemeral that it even existed, right?
Taken together, I would disagree with ephemeral in the sense that we have injuries, plus we have testimony.
Well, we have injuries, which the only injury is there was a puncture wound. Nobody ever said it was necessarily, and it was very superficial, and it didn't require any. It just scabbed over, and we know that he was hit in the chest, so I don't know why it necessarily has anything to do with a shank. But moreover, if one person, this is what I was asking before, if one person has a shank, why does that mean that another person has, I understand he could have control over it, but why does that give rise to the notion that he did have control over it?
Well, I think, first of all, with regard to the injuries, it's not just a puncture mark. We also have the slice marks.
But skip the injuries. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with whether or not this person had knowledge and intent to possess that weapon. He has to have that, doesn't he?
Well, he does.
What proof was there that he did?
We have the gang expert's testimony that
to possess this weapon that was used at that time, what proof is there?
Well, it would be the proof, again, first of all, they were all involved in the removal. That's clear from the circumstances where they invite him to this card game.
This is why I'm trying to understand what the constructive possession means. If one person has a shank, and they all get together and they say, we're going to have this attack. And the guy says, well, look, this is my shank, and I will use my shank, but I'm not letting anybody else use my shank, but I'll use my shank. Do the other people have constructive possession of his shank?
I would say under those specific circumstances, no. However,
all
that's
right, so
not...
What evidence do we have that those people had... He had a shank, and he used it. Let's assume that for this purpose, and that they agreed he was going to use it. Suppose all that is true. Why do they have constructive possession of his shank?
All gang members are supposed to have access to weapons.
That's different, but that's a different weapon. They're each supposed to have a weapon, but he didn't have a but there's no evidence that he did, so we're not talking about some other weapon that he may have had control, that he may have had possession of. That's his weapon. On that theory, you could arrest any gang member anywhere for having a weapon because they're supposed to have a weapon. We have no evidence of that weapon, the one that was his weapon.
Well, we're sort of using that analysis, we're taking evidence apart. If we put
that's what one does when one tries to figure out whether there's evidence of something.
Right. But
another question would be, are you saying that the only evidence that was in the record regarding any knowledge or intent to use a shank would have been the expert testimony that gang members in general would keep weapons? Is that what you're saying was the only evidence that Mr. Lucero had knowledge and intent and the ability to have access and control of this shank? Is that the only evidence?
I disagree with that, Your Honor, simply because...
I'm asking you, is that the only evidence? Is that the only evidence? If that's not the only evidence, what other evidence is there?
No, and the answer is we have the coordinated nature of this attack where all three defendants get together, they have this ruse of this card game, they all end up attacking him. When you draw that with the gang expert's testimony and look at all that evidence...
All right, so in your view, and this is what I'm trying to understand, it is constructive possession if they get together and they agree that one person is going to use that person's shank to attack this person. I mean, that's your position. I don't know if it's right or wrong, because no one's really told me what constructive possession is under California law, but that's your understanding. It doesn't matter whether Lucero himself had any authority to either use the shank or to tell the other guy how to use the shank, as long as the other guy was using it as part of a joint attack.
Well, no, my understanding of California law is that there has to be some ability to exercise possession.
All right, so what is the evidence of that, as opposed to the fact that they agreed that this other guy was going to use his shank in his way to do this?
And actually, let me backtrack on that answer, Your Honor, because we also have aiding and abetting liability on this case, which was instructed on.
But that's different. That's not how you got to the constructive possession of the shank. That was a separate count with separate conviction, right?
I don't know that it was. I honestly haven't briefed that, but I do know that the jury was instructed on aiding and abetting and said that.
You think he could have been convicted of aiding and abetting the constructive possession of the possession of a shank?
I would think so.
Well, even so, he has to have intent and knowledge to exercise dominion and control over the weapon. And I've asked you before if there's anything other than the expert testimony. You said it was the coordinated nature of the attack. But that goes to an attempt to attack. It doesn't go to an attempt or an intention to possess a weapon. What evidence do you have that this defendant had the intention and the knowledge to possess a weapon?
It would be the nature of the attack plus the expert testimony.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Your time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal.
Very briefly on the first point, I'd just like to point the court to two areas in the briefing that I think will be helpful with respect to the testimonial issue. In the opening brief at page 32, I cite the prosecutor's language to the jury where the prosecutor said, bingo, right there, a testimonial in writing from Armando Soldier Lopez, premeditated attempted murder. That's at AOB 32. And then in the reply, the prosecutor, we cite the evidence that the prosecutor characterized it as a quote-unquote first-person narrative by Lopez, which was an admission by him, quote-unquote, I did this. That's how the prosecutor characterized
it. That's, of course, true. Now, my understanding is that if after a murder, somebody goes to their girlfriend and says, I did this, and tells them in great detail what happened, that is not testimonial.
Under the law, as I understand it, Your Honor, it depends, again, as we discussed, on the circumstances. So, for example, there are the cases, I think it's the Davis case, where there is a domestic abuse situation and it's an interview, right, by officers in that situation. The question is, the husband and wife are separated.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about somebody just goes up to, you know, and feels terrible, you know, is all upset and just tells what happened.
And I understand that, Your Honor, and I think it all ties back to the point you were making in
that's a narrative. I mean, it does.
I think it ties back into the point below that this everyone agreed, and the prosecutor strongly characterized it, again, as a first-person narrative, as a quote-unquote testimonial admission by the co-defendant. And I think that
the question is whether or not it was testimonial at the time it was made. At the
yes.
time it was made, not the time it's later offered in trial. Of course, when it's offered in trial, it has a testimonial purpose to it. But this is whether the party who made the statement and the other party who's making it too, that was part of anticipated testimony or not.
And again, the closest analogy I have is the Esparza case, where the investigation had already been initiated, just as this case. The statement was made unsolicited by the government, just as this case. So those are, I think, the two most analogous facts, Your Honor, to that point.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your argument. An interesting case. Lucero v. Alvarez submitted. We'll go to Alvarez-Zaratino versus Sessions.